It's Saturday, January 28th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today's rundown, a bit of geek news, as we do every week, a discussion with Microsoft Excel tips and tricks expert Bob Olmless, and during the second half, we'll welcome your conversation with questions and comments about technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we'll focus on geek news and Microsoft Excel with author Bob Olmless. His book, It Isn't Excel, It's Magic, or This Isn't Excel, It's Magic. Very cool book. Lots of tips and tricks for people that use Excel, and it's kind of gotten me re-excited, if you will. That's not a word, but it's gotten me excited about Excel. So I recommend it. But this show is not just about us talking and talking to experts. It's also about you and what's wrong with your life and technology. So during the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can contact us right now by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. This is Geek Speak. Welcome. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks John Tracy, technical support engineer at Surf Control, Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, and Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance. Welcome, geeks.
Morning. Good morning.
Before we get in our conversation with our guest, Bob Olmless, This Isn't Excel, It's Magic is his book. We're going to do some geek news. I'm going to start with Mr. Tracy. John, hi. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Let's see. On February 3rd, NASA's going to launch a new satellite. What they're going to do is they're going to take an old Russian spacesuit and they're going to toss it out of the airlock of the IIS. I'm sorry.
You just said that they're going to take an old spacesuit.
They're going to take an old spacesuit
and throw it out the lock
on the space station.
Why?
What they want to do is see what is the effect. They're going to have the temperature controls turned off. There's going to be no life support running in the suit. What they want to see is what are the effects on the suit when there's no temperature control, no temperature regulation going on. They're also going to have a radio transmitter, and they're going to be transmitting on FM 145990. So if you've got a very large antenna and you can tune to that channel, you'll be able to hear it as it goes by. It's going to be broadcasting in different languages. It's going to have its telemetry information. It's going to have its heat, the temperature inside and outside. Mm-hmm. They expect it's going to last about 2 to 4 days. They're also going to be having a series of code words that they're going to be asking different schools, different students, and different ham operators to, figure out what these code words are in reference to. And they're going to have one static picture that you can download.
But John, why?
Yeah, what's the point of it?
Well, they pretty much, I guess, have this old spacesuit. They don't know what to do with it.
No, they so let's throw it out the airlock.
They want to see what is the long-term effect of a spacesuit that has no internal temperature regulation.
So basically, okay. I mean, I get that. I get to some extent that they want to test that one thing. It seems to me that this is kind of a high-profile, exciting way to do that.
Yes.
And that's probably the second part of it, is to get people excited about what's going on.
Well, there's always been a big ham community, ham radio operating community that contacts this space shuttle, the International Space Station. They have a ham radio up there. They have an amateur ham radio up on the space station. Mm-hmm. And they talk to students. They talk to other operators. They love to talk to students as they fly over their schools. And, the students can ask them questions. So this is kind of continuing in that tradition.
So keeping a connection directly with the space station.
Exactly.
And feeling a part of it. I like it. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense, especially if they've got some junk that they don't know what to do with. They just want to throw it out the airlock. I mean,
right.
That's what it sounds like.
It's going to launch on February 3rd. They expect it to last for 2 to 4 days. And, if you want to see where it's going to be and if it's going to be passing over you to see if you can link to it, you can go to science.nasa.gov/realtime /JPass. Oh my God. You know what? We got to put this up on the site. /25/JPass. It's a NASA site. Go up to NASA.gov.
Or Google will probably work for it. The spacesuit, they're expecting it to only last a few days because the inside
batteries are
going to
run out. The batteries are probably going to last. They are putting a bunch of extra batteries in it, so it'll last longer than it normally would have. And they're going to have the temperature controls off, so it'll last longer than it normally would have. So it is going to be, they think they're going to spin it. They're not sure yet. They're going to try to spin it to see if it affects the communication or not, and to see what the effects are.
Okay, I like it. Kind of raw experimentation in space.
And it's a Russian idea. These are the people who use pencils in space.
Right. That's a great thing. NASA or the U.S. government spent a lot of money trying to make a pen work in space.
Millions of dollars.
A gas-pressurized pen that could write in zero gravity.
Really cool pen, blah, blah, blah.
The ink flow was the problem.
There's no gravity. Right. Yeah. So what do the Russians do? They just bring pencils. I mean, it's perfect. Anyway, go on. Miles, your news story, sir.
With regard to Google.
I've heard of them.
Yes. Google has the cached links. Whenever you make a search, many of the links will have a cached, the word cached on there, and you click on it, and it doesn't go to the actual server that holds the information. It's actually Google servers that have a copy of the site that you're going to.
Okay.
And this is for speed reasons. Maybe the site has gone down, or maybe the site's slow, you know, things like that.
I use it all the time.
Right. And a lot of people do. However, it's brought up copyright concerns with some folks, talking about, well, they're copying the data from that site. How is that okay? And a district court in Nevada has now ruled that the Google cache is considered fair use.
Good.
Because they do – the first link that's on there – first off, they're saying this is Google cache. The actual link to the site is at the top. And it's clear that you are looking at someone else.
Right.
You know, someone else's view of that site.
What would the complaint be? I mean, presumably the site has wanted this information to get out. The people that put up the information wanted this information to be shared, where they wouldn't have put it on the internet.
Not always.
So that's kind of it's the wrong place to store stuff if you don't want people to know about it. That's for sure. So what would be the issue?
Well, see, that's the funny thing. Not everyone agrees on that. The initial reasons for the web, for example, and TCP/IP networks, which is what the internet is based upon, were not made with, for example, security in mind.
Right.
They were made for open access and for the endpoints, not for centralized access to data, but for everyone to share with everyone else. And it's only after everyone's come on there that's saying, oh, wait, but that doesn't fit our business model.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
So is that the issue, though? Is there some company that has a business model where Google Cache is actually interfering with its business model?
It's been a lot of different large people that have a vested interest in copyright, publishing companies.
I just don't see what's really difficult about what Google's doing with respects to copyright, except that maybe they're, you know, what could they get upset about that?
Well, it's the same folks that had a problem with what's called deep linking, which is linking
directly inside,
into sites. A particular site, particular page inside of a site, as opposed to
I get
the
that. So let's say a company has some interesting content that everybody wants to know about, and they want you to read through it a certain way, want to go through the site a certain way, and they're selling advertising on those sites. And then when Google indexes the site and shows you the article without having to look at all that advertising or those steps, it could affect what they've planned.
It's all about advertising revenue.
Now, the important thing to know is you can tell Google automatically not to cache your site. So there is that feature. But I'm going to go on because I want to get to Drew. Hi, Mr. Meyer. What's up, man?
Good morning. Well, I saw this headline and I got really excited. It says, "Video captures octopus attack on sub in BC."
Yay!
I saw that movie when I was little.
Exactly. So
wait,
I started thinking.
Wait, it happened 2,000 years ago?
Yeah,
I think
Captain Nemo.
Columbia. Go on.
The Nautilus and all that. Well, so it turns out this guy has a remote-controlled submarine, and there's a picture of it here, and it's sort of, I don't know, as big as a trunk, maybe, like a steamer trunk. And this octopus jumped on it, and he put the thrusters in reverse because he had a camera on the submarine. He was watching this all happen underwater. The video's not out on the web yet, but we'll let you know when we do find it. And the sub in reverse, the thrusters spewed all this gravel into the face of the octopus, who grumpily let go and slithered off into the nether regions of the sea. So it's really not like, you know, this gnashing beak was at the porthole men were getting their harpoons ready.
Darn.
So anyway, although it did happen, which is, nobody really understands why. It says here that naturally such large, powerful animals deserve respect, but that old octopuses become what we call senescent or senile, reaching the end of their life, and sometimes their actions are very inappropriate. So maybe this was an older octopus who was just crotchety and the submarine came too close.
There's some great footage on video Google about an octopus eating a shark in a marine lab. I'm not sure.
Wow. They were worried about whether the octopus would be able to hide from the other predators. It was the top of the food chain.
it was really quite impressive to see. John, I'm going to go to you for the next and probably last news story, but go ahead.
Do you want gravitational microlensing or do you want the big copper slugs you're going to throw at Mars?
How are you going to do that? I think I'm going to go with the microlensing because that's actually really wonderful.
I want to hear about the slugs.
Okay, recently in the news, we've all heard about a new planet that was found 20,000 light years away, which is basically near the center of the galaxy, Milky Way galaxy.
Is it a really big planet?
It's about 5 times the size of Earth, which when you're talking about planets that you're seeing from far away, it's small. Usually we're finding gas giants, Jupiter-size planets.
How, pray tell, were they able to find this planet?
Through an event called gravitational microlensing. What happens is you've got a star in between us, or a dense gravity object, which a star is, in between us and the planet and its star system, 20,000 light years away. What happens is... Einstein proposed that when you've got a dense material like a star, it bends space-time. Think of it like a tablecloth that you're holding between a bunch of people. You throw something heavy, like a bowling ball in the middle, it's going to sag where the bowling ball is. It's going to pull
it. So
if
you and I are sitting on that tablecloth and the bowling ball is right between us, mm-hmm. how do I get to use that bowling ball to see you more clearly?
It's going to bend the light that's going around it.
So like if I roll a marble at you, that'd be like the photons coming, or you roll a marble at me, that'd be photons coming from you, the distant planet, me.
If the marble's going fast enough, which light is, going speed of light, instead of colliding with it, instead of being sucked in with the gravity or going in orbit around it, it'll curve around it. It'll follow that curve around the indentation.
So you're actually throwing your light not at me, but to my right or left, and instead this gravitational body would rotate it towards me.
Right.
So how is that a lens?
Lenses work by bending light. Mm-hmm. If you bend light, you can change the properties of it so that it displays differently.
Why is this called a micro lens and not a gravity lens? I mean, why is micro lensing now becoming something that we can use, I should say?
It's because we have better equipment that's able to take advantage of this. We've also been able to find and predict micro lensing events. We can say, this star is going to be in position that when we look at this other star, it'll be in between us, and it'll create a microlensing.
Gotcha. So you know a distance of a solar system, a star. You know a difference in another one, another star, and you go, oh, yeah, actually, we're at the same. That star is halfway between. Therefore, if it passes in between us, we can use it as a microlens, or whatever the range is.
And they're using them to look at the larger Magellanic cloud.
And I guess it's called microlensing because it's micro effects of gravity on light.
Yeah, because it's not a huge effect. I mean, you're just slightly bending the light as it goes around.
Very cool.
So it's really important because we're using it to see further than we've ever been able to see before, and we're able to find this small planet. The way we find planets right now is either with a star wobbles, and so we infer a planet's gravitational effect on that star, or the light of the star dims and increases as the planet passes in front of it.
Right.
By doing that, we can find large planets. This is the first time we found a fairly small planet that's not right next to the star. This was about the orbit of Neptune.
Wow.
It's a big, rocky, icy planet, as opposed to a hot,
gaseous,
rocky planet that's right next to it, or a gaseous planet. So it's a brand new type of planet.
All right.
Wow. That means there could be lots out there that we just haven't seen.
That's what they're inferring from
is
that they're more common than gas giants.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Trox. With me in the air room are geeks John, Miles, and Drew. We've been talking a little bit about geek news, but now I want to get on to with our subject at hand, which is This Isn't Excel, It's Magic. An author of that book, Bob Olmless, is on the phone with us. Welcome, Bob, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, let me just tell you a little bit of background about Bob. Bob is a Microsoft Excel MVP, which is a title that's given to Microsoft to people that contribute a lot to their news groups. So Bob has a lot of information about Excel, and he likes to share it with people. That's basically what an MVP means. And he's also been a contributing editor in Inside Magazine Excel, and Inside Microsoft Excel, excuse me, having written over 300 articles on all aspects of Excel. And for 10 years, he's co-led the New York City's PC Excel Special Interest Group. He has authored several chapters in various Excel books on tips, tricks, and array formulas. He is the author of International Institute of Learning's Master's Certification in Microsoft Excel. Bob is the Excel guru, and he's on GeekSpeak today to talk about his new book, This Isn't Excel, It's Magic. You can get this book from IIL Publishing, and you can find that on our website, geekspeak.org. Bob, when I grabbed this book, I was kind of excited. I asked for this book, I think, at one point when someone mentioned it through Threads. And because I've always picked up Excel as a solution for any kind of math problem. And I don't know, does that happen to you? You just kind of use Excel for everything?
Just about, yeah. I often use it instead of word processing, which is probably the wrong thing to do. but I certainly use it when I want to organize something that has some graphics to it, because I can more easily position the objects right in an Excel worksheet than I can in Word, or and I'm not all that skilled in any kind of drawing program.
Now, does Excel Excel allows for image and manipulation and prints
absolutely
it pretty well? Yeah. Well, I don't use it as a layout program, but I have to say that I can't recall what this guy's was, but I had some file I could not print anywhere, and I finally threw it into Excel and was able to print. So I remember having that experience.
Yep.
But Excel, I mean, it's basically a very complicated spreadsheet program. I've seen Apple, you know, and Microsoft have a really great deal where Microsoft keeps on making Office for the Macintosh. But on the Macintosh, they have pretty much everything that's in Office except an Excel version. And I believe the reason is that it's because Excel is so good, they don't feel they can compete with it.
It's actually not true. There is Excel for the Macintosh.
Microsoft. What I'm saying is that Apple is actually slowly creating applications that do everything that the Microsoft Office suite does. One thing that Apple has not created is Excel. There's a great Excel on the Macintosh, but it's a Microsoft product. So I just think it's kind of, I think that Apple's holding on, if you will, to Microsoft making software for their platform because Excel is so good. I mean, that could be just a harebrained idea. But let's talk a little bit about your book. It's basically like 90 or 85 different quick tricks on using Excel in neat ways.
Right.
So I want to ask you one thing that a lot of people don't know, and you use multiple examples of this in your book, and that is, I hope you don't have to answer that, Bob.
I do not have to.
The thing that most people don't know about Excel is you can actually use the output of the, you can use conditional formatting. Can you tell me a bit about conditional formatting?
Sure. Conditional formatting can be applied to a cell or a group of cells that takes on either a different font name or different font size or borders or pattern, on color, bold, italic, depending on the condition of something else. And the condition could be this particular cell, whenever it becomes more than 100, then it could turn red, that cell being obviously containing a formula.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be a cell that doesn't contain a formula. It can just be a number, and its color can change if some other cell takes on some other value.
Yeah, and that's one of the strengths. I mean, in a use case, you've got, let's say, a whole array of receipts from the bank or something, and you want to know when your total gets to a point that's below 1,000. So you can set that field that has that number in it. Of course, the number would actually show you whether it got to under 1,000, but you can also say, I want this to highlight to red when it gets to that number because I want to be aware of it. So it's a way to bring focus on things that are happening in your sheet.
Yeah, I actually have a bunch of credit cards, and sometimes I forget to make a payment, and I have the last payment date. Whenever that date happens to be more than a month old, I know I haven't heard from the company in a while, and I have to contact them for the last bill. It turns red.
Oh, very cool. Do you do all your personal financing in Excel?
Yes. Well, no, I keep records of it in Quicken.
Mm-hmm.
But any kind of calculations I make, I do in Excel.
All right. So let's. I'm going to throw another couple of things at you. One of the things that you refer to all the time as an easy choice is something I didn't even know. It's like it's autofill values down or across. Can you explain that to me?
I didn't hear the question.
Oh, sorry, autofill.
Yes.
When you can type one and then below it type two and then you can say continue doing this.
Yes.
How do you do that?
Okay. Well, actually, you can do it just by typing one. If I type one in a cell, that cell has a slightly darker bottom right border, and if you hover the mouse over that, it'll change the cursor shape to a cross or crosshair.
Okay.
If you drag this down, it will just fill, just type a 1, it'll just fill all ones all the way down. But in the case of a 1, if you hold the control key down, it'll then change the number. It'll be 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on.
Okay, when I'm doing this, it seems to... Oh, I see the little shape. Right, so it cops down 1. So if you do a control, it actually does like a calculation of what you're doing.
Right. Now, if you had the 1, then the 2 below it, you don't need to hold the control anymore because it understands the pattern if you select both the 1 and the 2 and then use that little fill handle.
Gotcha. And on the Macintosh, it's the option key, by the way. Okay, so this book is basically full of these tips and tricks. What... When you go and speak with people, and you've got a great little story in your intro to the book, but I'll let you tell another one if you want. How do people recognize you as the guru you are?
I guess mainly from the Excel news groups in on both Microsoft and the I forget actually the name of it, the Excel Peach General News Group. I don't know the name of it. It's bookmarked, so I just
yep. That's fine.
Post there.
News groups, huh?
I actually started 1986 or so playing with Excel, or 1987, whenever it first came out, with version 0.99. And because I was a contributing editor to that magazine you mentioned up front, I got some notoriety there, you know, some recognition. Over the years, I was speaking at different conventions from Microsoft, as well as the Advisor Developer Conference. And
let me interrupt. I was trying to get to the point that it's very common. One of the stories you've got in your book is a experience of being at Excel seminar. Someone speaking about Excel and doing some complicated features, and you speak up from the audience and say, "You know, you can do this a little easier." Is that which you know? If I was speaking, I think I'd appreciate that kind of input. But that does take some guts to know what you're talking about.
That's true. I love getting the kind of feedback I got. Actually, it was last year. A particular tip I have in the book is how to summarize a bunch of numbers on the right side and below. It's just the sum across and the sum down. And what most people would do is they'd use the sum tool or even type in the formula, sum formula of the range,
mm-hmm.
and fill that down, perhaps using the fill handle or just selecting the range and doing edit fill down,
mm-hmm.
or even the control D down arrow. And then putting in the same formula below, making the formula correct.
And copy it across.
And drag across to the right. And this wasn't my discovery, but it was something from Excel 1.5 I read about. And it seemed to have people forgotten or never knew, because they didn't have Excel 1.5, that you can select the entire range and include an extra row and an extra column, the blank row and column just with the range. And just single-click the sum tool, and it does all that. It puts the sums on the right and the sums below.
Oh, that's cool.
Wait, what do you select again?
It's got a block of numbers.
Yeah.
And select that block and one extra column.
To the right or the left?
And one extra row.
Oh, okay. Top or bottom or right or left?
Yeah. And then just single-click the sum tool.
And it'll go both across and above, up and down?
Yep.
That's a nice feature. I like that. You know, one of the things you talk about quite a bit is ranges and using ranges. And I think that a lot of people, when they start using Excel, the verbiage becomes complicated. What is a range in Excel?
A range is any selection of cells.
So any selection, any shape.
Yep. So A1 itself could be a range. A1 through C5 is a range. A1 and D6 and F22, those three cells, that's a range.
So any selection of cells.
Any selection of cells.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be a selection. It could be a range that references a particular selection.
Right.
That doesn't have to be selected. You can also define range names.
Right. Tell me about defined ranges.
Defined range, first of all, is a lot simpler to understand if you're coming back to a workbook. It's instead of having equals, let's say E22 plus G25, if it said equals taxes plus benefits or whatever, I don't get anything.
Right.
Good. You know, if it has the words, it's easy to understand what the formula does.
So how do you define what those words would mean? So let's say you want to just you want to multiply a whole bunch of numbers by the current tax, but you don't want to hard code that in. You want to reference into somewhere else.
Right. So you would do an insert menu, insert name, and then over to the right, define. And that's where you define a name, insert name, define. And you can give it a name like current rate.
Okay.
And then in the refers to box, you would type the number, let's say 5%, or perhaps you want to include an equal sign, equal 5%, whatever the number is. And then so it doesn't even refer to a cell. It's a name. Names often refer to cells, but can also refer to values. So if you have the number 5% in a cell, you could give that cell a name, and you can call that current rate, and then you can refer to the, still refer to the name current rate. But again, it could just be a name that refers to a value. And then in your formulas, you could say equals the sum of these cells times current rate.
Okay. I hope that people followed that. I partially did, but I want to invite everyone to join us. Call us up. Ask Bob some Excel questions. He probably can answer them. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can ask us questions via the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org and click Contact Us. I'll give it those phone numbers in just a second. GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivered office supplies, shipping via FedEx, UPS, DHL, and more. Details at businesswithpleasure.com.
KUSB co-sponsors UCSC Arts and Lectures presentation of the Pablo Ziegler Trio for Nuevo Tango, Friday, February 3rd at 8 p.m. at the UCSC Recital Hall. Tickets available at 459-2159.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Miles Elam. Also in the air is John Tracy and Drew Meyer. We're speaking with the author of This Isn't Excel, It's Magic, Bob Olmos, and we're talking all about Excel. We're taking your calls and questions regarding Excel, preferably, but of course we'll open to any question you may have and may want us to answer, whether it be correctly or humorously. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, the phone lines are open. We'll take your calls with questions and comments about technology. We'll take questions about Excel. Phone numbers 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And I want to go ahead and welcome people to also participate in a way that would be, if you've got some frustrations about Excel, that's more than welcome as well. All right. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. So, Bob, back to what we were talking about, which is Excel and ranges. One thing that I've found is it's quite nice to do, what's a useful feature of Excel that you can't really do without ranges, and I prefer to do it with defined ranges, and that is to have your data, if you will, on one sheet and have your presentation of that data on another sheet so that you can do things. It's kind of hard to explain without the direct purpose in mind, but you know what I'm speaking about, right?
Sure.
So how do you do that? How do you reference a sheet outside of the sheet you're currently on? I mean, first off, Excel, the document itself is called a workbook. And the reason it's called a workbook is it's got multiple sheets. And you can see those tabs on the bottom. So how, when you're in one field, do you reference another sheet?
Well, again, this could be done with defined names, but more likely it's done with a cell reference with as appended by a sheet name. So if I have the sheets the way they come, sheet 1, sheet 2, sheet 3, if I want to reference cell E5 on sheet 2, because that contains the number I need, I could just on any other sheet type an equal sign, and I can type sheet 2, an exclamation point, E5.
Okay.
Or I could just type an equal sign and then switch to the sheet and click on the cell, and it'll put it right in the formula bar for me.
So, I'm sorry, when you do the equals, you can actually select a tab to, but you're still in that same field.
That's right.
Okay, I didn't know that aspect. That makes it a little easier. I always assume, I feel like whenever I'm in a formula definition, if you will, an Excel field, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm going to break something if I click around. Because there's so often, so often you start typing and then you're like, oh, I want a different field, and you select a different field, and then you've added a reference to that field, and it gets all complicated.
Yeah, it's very hard to break Excel. I have done it, but it's very hard to do. When you're done with whatever you're doing, if you click around, you can always edit the result in the formula bar.
I do a lot of importing of data from Excel from other applications, if you will, into Excel to play around with it.
Yes.
And one of the things I'll find is that sometimes the dates are formatted in a way that Excel doesn't understand.
Right.
I like to format dates by the year, the month, and the day without sometimes dashes in between, but sometimes without any dashes. And the reason for that is that it alphabetically works to list them. So how can you make like a 2006-01-28, today's date, turn into something that actually is a date in Excel?
Okay, well, there's a couple of ways. There's one, I'll just give the correct way, but there are formula-based ways. There's a built-in way. You can select that cell, and if you have several of them in a row, you can select them all. You go to the data menu, there's an option that says text to columns.
Okay, text to columns. Text to columns, okay.
Okay, you're doing this with me?
No, I'm just trying to remember the entry, okay. But yeah.
And then it comes up with a dialogue. It's a wizard step, a three-step wizard. The first step asks you, is this a delimited field or a fixed width field? And you could ignore that because it doesn't matter. So you click the next button, and it turns out the next button is about whether there are delimiters or not, depending on the first one you chose. But again, this one doesn't matter.
Okay.
So you click to the step three, and there's a column data format on the right. And you can choose, you can tell if that is it a date. You can select either general text date or do not import. When you select date, there's then a drop-down that you can tell it this is your month day, and Excel will then understand it. It also gives you an option of where do you want to place the result. You can leave it in the current cell, which will overwrite it, so you wouldn't see that, or you can put it someplace else, perhaps right next to it. And when you then click the finish button, what I'm looking at now is in cell A2, I have 2006-01-28. But in cell B2, I have 1/28/2006.
So Excel knows that it's a date. So that's the trick, is text to, what is it called?
Text to columns.
Text to columns.
Menu.
Okay, so it's kind of like an internal importing feature, if you will.
Right.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Terry, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question?
Hi, am I on?
Yeah, you are.
Hi, yes. I appreciate the expertise on Excel. And I also appreciate what our fairly complex explanations being made simple, and that's why I'm asking the question about pivot tables. I've seen some sheets that I've inherited that have pivot tables on them, and they seem very useful. I'm at a loss how to set them up, and maybe a newbie's explanation of what a pivot table is.
Okay, Terry, can you take those off air so we can...
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, Terry, for the question.
All right, thanks.
All right, Bob, what is a pivot table?
A pivot table is a way of summarizing large amounts of data almost instantly. If the data is oriented in lists or a table where there's no description on the left of what goes across the row, but all the description are like column headings that contain something like name, address, date, amount,
okay,
anything you want. And many of the columns will have repeated data. For example, one of the columns might be region, and you'll have, 50 columns containing northeast and 20 columns containing south, et cetera.
Okay.
And the thing could be, 30,000 rows long. A pivot table is a menu command-driven startup. You go to the data menu down to pivot table and pivot chart report, and it asks you what kind of... data you're looking at. For the most part, it's an Excel list.
Okay.
That's in there,
so,
or database.
So what you just
throw you.
What you just described, a whole bunch of rows with a header on them and information in it, that's called an Excel list, is that?
Yes.
Okay. And so, so you go into this feature called pivot tables.
Right.
And then what do you do? Go on.
And it also brings up a wizard. So once you accept the first default, which is the database, you can actually just click the finish button and skip the wizard entirely. And it'll guide you visually through what you want to see. You can put, let's say I have just region and amount, make it simple. And I have thousands of rows of the different regions. And maybe there's only five different regions, aside from northeast, southwest, maybe northeast, who knows.
Okay.
So the result would contain only five rows. The first row would say... north, and the second row would say south, and so on, and the sum of all the north values would be placed to the right of it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so it summarizes it right away.
But it's not affecting that original list.
No, it's placed somewhere else. You can place it next to it, below it, above it, or
a different
sheet.
Okay. So what let's use an example that would be the north, west, southeast. So let's say you've got a whole bunch of offices and you're just basically trying to find out how, let's say, paperclips are selling in the different divisions.
Okay. Well, aside from paperclips, let's do paperclips and some other tool. Paperclips,
okay.
And
pencils.
Staplers.
Okay, staplers.
Okay.
Go on.
So the list could be as long as it is, and you have all the paperclip sales and whatever.
And let's say you have the totals by zip code. So you have totals of paper clips and staplers by zip code, and then you've somehow figured out the zip code is in northwest, north south, I mean northeast, whatever.
Okay.
So you have a large list of it.
Okay. Well, your resultant pivot table it doesn't have to include the zip code. It could include just the north, southeast, west.
Okay.
Or it could. It's a choice to you that you can keep on changing. It's not fixed in stone, whatever you do. So down the left would be perhaps north, south, east, west, and maybe if you want, you can even get the zip codes that refer to the north region right next to north, and
okay.
The zip codes that refer to the south region not right next to south, even though the original list has them strewn all over the place in a haphazard
form. So your new pivot table is the new look at the other data,
right?
And in this
it's
situation,
a summary look.
In this situation, it would be by region total. So on the left, it would say region, and then across the top, it might say all the different regions, and then there'd be a total where those intersect, and that would be the total from that other table.
Yes.
And that's a pivot table.
Right, and one of the reasons it's called a pivot table is like the way you just described it, the regions went across the rows.
Right.
I'm sorry, across the columns in one row, but I can also just drag it to another area, and it'd go down one column across several rows.
It's hard to, of course, talk about this on radio. I'm
sure.
Hoping that people follow.
There is actually a website I would recommend that does a tutorial of lots of different pivot tables, and it's one that you can watch, sit back and watch it run. And it's datapigtechnologies.com.
DataPig.
DataPig Technologies, all one word. And if you go to that site and you scroll down, you see a whole section on pivot tables and things you can do with them. You start from the beginning and play it's actually interactive. You see the mouse move and so on. Very good way to learn about pivot tables.
Great. All right, we're going to go ahead and take another call, and from Santa Cruz, Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
I was interested in what you said about the date changing to red when it was for your credit card payment. I was wondering how you did that.
Okay. Well, I have, actually, let me just bring it right up so I could talk from experience.
What we're talking about is the feature is called conditional formatting. Conditional formatting is the term. If you select a field, if anybody wants to follow along with it, select a field in Excel, any field, and then go up into formatting and choose conditional formatting, you'll see what Bob's about to explain.
Okay. Hold on one second. Here we go. So I have payment dates. That was the last date that I made the payment. And the whole list of payment dates is, if I go to the format menu, down to conditional formatting, and the first thing you would see if you did that is on the left it would say cell value is, and I'm not going to leave it that way. I'm going to change that cell to formula is, which are the two choices are cell value is, which is the default, and formula is. So I'm changing it to a formula.
Okay.
And I have a somewhat complicated formula. I'll try to simplify this one. I have equals today, which is a built-in Excel function, which is today's
right.
date, and I have an open and closed parentheses because that's what the today function requires. Equals today minus, and then I have the cell reference where that contains the date. In this particular case, I'm looking at cell H10. So today minus H10 greater than 30.
Okay.
So the date that's in there is January 14th. Today, which is being the 28th, minus that is just 14. It's not greater than 30, so the conditional formatting doesn't take place. But as soon as February 14th occurs, or whatever the date would be, maybe the 12th, that's 30 days older, it turns red because in this conditional formatting, I click the format button, and I just click the patterns tab, and I click the red color. So it'll only be red when that condition is met.
Now, when you're playing with this, don't use date stuff, because if you use date stuff, you're going to have to wait till that date happens to see the formatting.
Right.
A good way to do this is to say, you know, if the number is less than 2, and then just change the field to be, you know, 1 or 4, and you'll see the formatting change back and forth. It's really cool.
Yeah, now, if you can do this to lots of cells at once, you would select all the cells and then use the active cell as the reference in the formula, and it will apply that to all. You don't have to visit each cell and do it over and over again.
Cool.
Right.
Now,
right.
What about when you make a new row and you, I mean, you obviously you're going to say when you do your payment in February on the 12th or something like that, you're going to write in another row. Is that formula going to be copied down to the row below?
You mean the conditional formatting?
The conditional formatting.
It depends on how many rows you have set up. Excel 2003, I think if you have five, maybe four, I think it's five rows in a row with the same kind of formatting, mm-hmm. anything you enter in the next row will take on that formatting.
Nice.
So in this case, you know, I have about seven credit cards. Some have I don't use anymore, but the data is still there. So when I insert a row, yes, that new row that was inserted does have the conditional formatting as well.
Tom, did this answer your question?
Yes, it does. I'm just wondering if you have that little trick in your book, because I'll probably need help with that formula.
About conditional formatting?
Yeah.
I don't think I do, because...
You do use it in a situation of turning something off by using a white font. So
yes.
You do have it in there.
I do use conditional formatting, but this aspect of it I don't use, because this is like the built-in standard asset. My book is not about teaching Excel. It's about teaching tricks that you don't normally find in other books.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, Bob, do you have a good recommendation for learning this kind of thing that Tom's trying to get really strong at?
Well, if you go to Google and type in groups, click on groups, and just type with the word Excel and the topic that you're interested in, like Excel conditional formatting, click enter, you'll probably get lots of information on it.
In groups. In groups.
Yes, in group.
Good, awesome. Good feature. Thank you very much, Tom, for the call.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to be like Tom and join our conversation, even if it is not about Excel, we'll take any calls with questions and comments. We've got a Mac expert, a Linux expert, a Windows expert, a hardware, software that works, and everything else. The phone numbers are...
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Even musical dialogue. 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can contact us by sending us email. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And we are checking our email. I'm not, because I'm talking, but John is kind of nodding his head, no email right now. So you're welcome to ask us questions about anything you want. And maybe we'll answer it. 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we're going to go on with other tips. Bob, by the way, this is KUSP. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, and this is Geeksp. My name is Lyle Troxell. We're speaking with Bob Olmos. He is the author of This Isn't Excel, It's Magic. And that is a really clear, specific thing you just told Tom, that this book is really about tips and tricks that don't come easy, if you will. I mean, you can learn a lot of the tricks and about how the features of Excel work by going into the help functions of Excel. But these things are things like, I have a giant row, a whole bunch of data, and I really want them double-spaced. How do I do that? How do I make it so there's an extra space in between them when I've got thousands of rows? How do you do
that? You want me to give that answer?
I would love it if you gave that answer. What the heck?
What most people would attempt to do is actually manually just click on a cell and do an insert. Click on a cell and do an insert. And people who are a little advanced might even try to write a macro to do that. But there's actually a technique that I discovered on my own several years ago, which is kind of cool. If you either insert a column or use an empty column next to where your data is, and you just type the number 1, 2 like we did in the beginning, row 1 contains a 1, row 2 contains a 2, you select them both, and if you double-click the fill handle, it'll go down as far as your data does, as long as there's no gaps in the data.
Nice.
If there is a gap in the data, you will need to drag this all the way down.
Okay.
Actually, you don't need to drag it. You can actually go to cell. Let's say another bottom row is 2,000. You can go to cell H2,000 if you happen to start in column H. And if you hold down the Shift key, you'll wind up with H1 selected, and H2,000 will be also selected from H1 through H2,000. Then you can just do an Edit Fill Series.
Okay.
You're
taking your data, all your rows of data, and you're putting just a number that goes down the row.
Right. So you're numbering all your data.
Okay.
You then copy that range, and you go to the bottom of the data right below the 2,000 and paste it in again. So you'll now have 1 to 2,000 followed by 1 to 2,000.
Okay.
Now you select all the data and make sure that the column that contains these numbers is the active column, and you can click on the sort tool, which is a little A to Z, or you can do data sort, just making sure that column is the column you're sorting by. So you're sorting the numbers 1 to 2,000 twice, so you'll get 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3. But where it's getting the data from is the second row 1 is the stuff at the bottom, which is totally blank.
So that's,
it sorts blank rows right into place.
I gotcha. I like it. So you're making two lists of numbers. One list has your data. The next list has blank rows. When you sort off that number, the rows get intersliced with your data.
Right.
And you get
that's,
two.
That's pretty instant.
I like it. All right, we've got an email from Michael in Monterey. He's got a similar question. He has a spreadsheet where each value going down the column is a function of the value above it. So it's picking up the information it needs from the cell above. The problem is when he inserts a new row, then the functions and the value below are not pointing to the right row anymore. It's always going to be off by one. Is there a way to do the insert that doesn't break that kind of a reference?
You mean, John, if I understand the question, he is referencing the row above it, but not the number right above him.
He's got a formula.
Yeah.
Referencing the one above it.
The cell right above or the row above other fields?
The row right above it.
Okay.
So, well, the cell right above it.
The cell right above.
So, therefore, when he's got several of these in series, so then when he inserts a new row, suddenly that series is broken by a blank row.
It's not copying the formula.
He wants the formula to continue following.
How do you do it?
Well, it should automatically do that. Depends on where he's inserting the row. I mean, if I have a formula, let's say in cell A...
Well, here, I've got his example.
Okay.
Okay, let's say he's got first cell is A1 equals 6, and then okay. A2 equals A1 times 3, and
okay.
then the next one is A3 equals A times 2, and the next one is A4 equals A3. Then he inserts a row at A3, and then it breaks it where it gets a blank between A2 and A4, and the new A4.
Because that's
it doesn't.
Column.
Everything gets adjusted. So it may be how is he inserting the row?
He doesn't specify.
Because if
but how would you do it to make it so where it automatically continue the formula?
I wouldn't do anything because it automatically does.
Well,
so
can you figure out why?
If I have in cell A3, like you said, A1 times 2, and I insert a row above row 3, that formula, of course, moves down to row 4, A4, and it still says equals A1 times 2.
So, I'm confused because we're talking about one row and then you're talking about row 3. Assuming
this is hard to do on the radio.
It sure is, isn't it?
Sure. If the user has an issue, if you want, I can give my email address, which may be dangerous.
Go ahead.
But, and people can email me particular questions. I'll be glad to respond.
All right, go ahead and give your email address. We're going to go on to
Bob Umlass, which is one word, B-O-B-U-M as in Mary, L-A-S as in Sam, @yahoo.com.
Thank you. And we're going to go to the next question on air, which is from Santa Cruz. Miles, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, good morning. Thanks a lot for your show. I like it a lot. I've been using Quattro Pro since sometime in the early 90s, and I've always enjoyed the heck out of it and found it very easy to do all the things I do, which admittedly is limited, but a lot of the formatting kinds of things you're mentioning are all easy to do there. And I'm just curious if you have any opinions about it or know of any differences that make Excel better.
Well, I had to look over the board to see the other geeks to say quietly, what is Quattro Pro? So it's an Excel-like application.
I think it predates Excel. I'm not sure about that.
Bob, do you know about it?
I've heard of it. I know it does predate Excel. There were quite a number of things that predated Excel. I've never even seen Quattro Pro.
Back in the day, you had Quattro Pro, Lotus 1-2-3,
right.
Trapeze. You had
Fox
Wing,
right.
Multiplan.
Fox Pro is the data.
That's right. I'm super
and,
calcs. What
yeah,
I
and over time, especially after Microsoft Office was released, basically the other ones died.
Yes.
Well, I have a version of Quattro Pro that came out, I think, this year. So.
Oh, really?
So they didn't die. They just faded from...
Just got overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I know. But, I can't imagine...
Okay, so you don't know the answer, but I think I use it in my office, and we have 7 computers running, and people who come here who have used Excel tell me they like Quattro Pro better, but I don't know.
Wow.
And I have Excel. I use it when I'm forced to.
But you like Quattro Pro more?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll have to try to get a copy of the application to see if I like it. Bob, you want to join me in that kind of pursuit to see? Or would you have to let someone pry Excel from your dead, cold fingers?
They'd have to pry Excel. I have no more room for books on my shelf.
Well, thank you very much, Miles, for the call.
Sure, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to go on off to Janelle in Monterey. Welcome to GeekSpeak. Ah, I see. Okay, how about Judith in Watsonville? Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, yeah. I had a question about an address book on Macintosh OS.
Okay.
And basically it's about the using V cards. I've made I have an address group set that I think other people in the group might like to have the contents of my address book.
So you'll be able to share that.
And I know that I can make V cards, but I didn't know if can people with Windows, do they have an address book thing that would be compatible with the V cards from the
V card does it in. Oh, go ahead, Miles.
Well, I mean, V cards actually are a universal thing nowadays,
right.
So anything can read a V card.
Oh.
In fact, I think the first time I saw a V card was on a Windows machine, not on a Macintosh.
So can something other than the address book function on the Mac read the V card, or is it just a?
Your email application can on the Macintosh besides the address book. I don't think so. I think you can open it with you can open it with a text editor, but it's not going to be fun to read. But if you take your entire group and export it as a V card and then email that V card to somebody, they should see all of it.
Okay. Well, I just thought I would offer to the group if they would like.
Yeah, one thing I'd be concerned about, of course, is that I hope the group is small. That's all.
Well, there's about 40 people in the group.
Yeah, but that's still people that they can all know each other. So it's not a situation where it's going to be like a spam potential.
Well, we have an online group already, and I just sent them a directory with the information, but I thought they might like to have it in that other format.
But you have an online group, like a Yahoo group already?
A Yahoo group, yeah.
So Yahoo has some pretty slick tools that will actually... data suckers. They'll pull all the stuff out of your, if you ask it to, they'll remove your address book and put it into the Yahoo address book, which then you can share with your Yahoo group.
I don't think it's really an email group that most of the people on the group are not very savvy about.
And you want to just use
the tools. It's basically we have the Yahoo group people can email one another.
Right.
Maybe there's a few people of us that actually go online and do anything.
Right. And someone out there, if they know more, please correct us. But with regard to V cards, I think V cards are an individual entry as a V card as opposed to an address group.
And a V card is
just
as a group.
I actually did a collection as a group. One
Never
time.
Never mind then. I stand corrected.
I thought a V card was a Microsoft specific Outlook format.
No.
Okay.
It's a VCF extension, which is
usable if it started off as Microsoft, everyone else has adopted it, so...
It's pretty open at this point, and you can do large groups in it.
The Yahoo tool, if you're interested, is called IntelliSync. You might want to check it out.
I used to work for that company.
Oh.
Well, it must be good.
So, Miles, no, I wouldn't recommend it at all, actually.
No,
but the thing is, doing that just puts your address book online. What you want to do is be able to give individual people ways to access the email list, individual emails, because, of course, you can use the Yahoo list to actually send emails to everybody. So, yeah, I think the V card's an okay thing to send to somebody. If they don't know how to open it and can't use it, they won't, and it's, you know, not a big deal. You could ask the group first. Anybody interested in everybody's emails in a V card format?
Yeah, that's what I thought I would ask.
I think that's a fine way to go.
If individuals, anybody would like it, and I'll email it to them in particular.
Judith, thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Man, we've got calls. People are waiting on the lines, but we got no time to take the calls. So I'm sorry if you're still waiting. We won't be taking your calls today. We're gonna
next week. We really recommend calling in
right at the 12 or the 10:30 mark. Yeah,
let's get the email address for Bob one more time.
Yeah, Bob, you want to hit us up? Bob,
sure,
I'll do it. Bob Umlas, BOBUMLAS @yahoo.com.
Can I also mention two other sites?
No. Yes, okay, of course you can. Please, please do.
There's a Excel User Conference, oneword.com. It tells about an Excel User Conference in Atlantic City coming up in April, which you might be interested in. It's a 2-3-day conference. I will be leading several sessions there, but it's great. And also, you can actually peer inside my book. If you go to amazon.com and type in my name, Bob Space Umlas, and then click on one of the links, you'll see my book, and you can actually browse through it.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob, for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. This program is supported by a grant from CruiseIO, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about CruiseIO membership is available online at CruiseIO.com or by calling 459-6301. Bob Olmos' book is This Isn't Excel, It's Magic. You can learn more information at geekspeak.org. Thank you to the geeks. Thank you for our phone answer, Rick Fillman. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at SantaCruzElectronics.com.